This is the UCLA Mindful Monday Meditation. Each week, Marvin G. Belzer, or one of our UCLA Mindful teachers, leads a 30-minute guided session offering a variety of themes and practices to cultivate self-awareness, emotion regulation, and increased well-being. Thanks for joining us.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Monday Meditation. Good to be with you. If you're new to meditation, hopefully I'll give some good advice. The basics are relatively simple and doable. There are dozens of types of approaches to meditation, probably hundreds, but the ones I know of, most of them will begin in the way we begin, using our ability to decide where to place our attention. And it is as easy if you can see, and maybe you can't, so this is a bad example, but if you can see my hand, you can decide to try to pay attention to the hand, the visual object that you can see on your screen. And that's doable, right? If you can't see, then there's my voice, so you can focus on the sound of the voice. This is how easy it is to meditate, really. And it does get harder if we try to do something like this for a longer period of time. But the point is, we don't have to do it perfectly over a long period of time, even though we spend time doing it. And so even when my other hand appears and is at least doing something a little bit more interesting, you can still exert make that effort to keep the attention on the hand that's not moving, right? So these are skills we have, and I invite you to set aside assumptions you have about how good you are at attending and your attention and all that. When we notice, so I'll invite you to focus on sounds, on sensations in our bodies. The reason we do this is there's something about using attention in this way, focusing on something relatively neutral and doing it for a while that has good effects in our minds. The mind can become calmer, more clear and stable and so forth. And then when stuff arises, like the other hand, right, drawing our attention, pulling it away, well, this is normal. It's quite, if they have the boring hand, and the other hand appears doing something even slightly more interesting, it's we're going to notice it. We're going to pay attention. Like, that's more interesting. And so quite naturally, even in when we're trying to pay attention to the breath, there'll be thoughts that occur to us, our to-do list for today, something that's on our mind, or even something that just pops into our mind. Often thoughts will occur, and then one thought leads to another quickly. And time goes by, and then at some point we realize, oh, right, I was going to try to observe my breath, but here I've been daydreaming or mulling something over or whatever. Perfectly normal and expectable. We don't have to figure out how to stop that. We certainly don't have to try to figure out how to clear our minds, a big misconception that many people seem to have. So when we notice the attention has drifted, we do pay attention. And indeed, we include in the meditation, even just briefly, noticing we're thinking. Often there will be emotions that are connected with the thoughts one way or another. These also can be part of our meditation. With emotions, we try to feel them, the physical, visceral component, often in our torso. But we don't turn this into a huge task so much as just this is an opportunity to be aware. And we don't have to rush, but if you're new to this, it's good to be kind of quickly coming back to that more or less neutral home base of the breath or wherever you're focusing. So that's the general picture for mindfulness meditation, as I understand it. And let's do it. So eyes can be open or closed. You might take a few deeper breaths as we begin. Slightly deeper in breath and out breath, just one way to begin. Letting your breath be normal. We'll come back to the normal breath in a minute. You might notice why you're here. What do you hope for? Maybe nothing in particular, just want to explore. Maybe something quite particular. Whatever it is, just kind of let that be part of the frame for beginning. And then letting your attention rest with sounds that you can hear. So we begin with sounds, just noticing what is coming in to this part of your experience. We don't try to hear everything or keep track. We're not going to have to write a report. We're not trying to get something out of the sounds. We do not have to get rid of other things that might be distracting us. Just in the midst of everything that is happening, notice that you can decide to give priority to some of the sounds that are happening moment after moment. This is very doable. So you can stay with sounds if you wish, come back to sounds whenever you wish. It's also good to practice with our bodies in a similar way. So when you wish, let your attention settle into your body, noticing the physical sensations that are noticeable: head, shoulders, arms and hands, torso, legs and feet. Same sort of attitude as with sounds, just not trying to make something happen or stop anything, just noticing generally some of the sensations in your body. As we feel into our bodies, it can be natural to notice the sensations connected with the ordinary breath. So, not breathing deeply the way we began. Just letting the breath take place. There tend to be some sensations. The abdomen, the chest, slight movement, rising, tensing with the in-breath. Falling, softening, dissolving with the out-breath. Flow, fine sensations at the nose as air comes in, as air leaves. So if that seemed a bit fast, like, wait a minute, what breath? Just how do you know you're breathing? So some sensations, right? Abdomen, chest, or nose. Might be very subtle, but the idea is we can be aware of something happening as we breathe. And these sensations tend to be pretty good for our purposes. So the idea would be just to let your attention rest, so to speak. In the abdomen, the chest, or the nose, wherever you can feel something as the in-breath begins. And then not rigidly or with force, but just kind of with quiet determination, just noticing what's happening there for a while. And of course, some moments there won't be much happening, then the in-breath begins and so forth. If for any reason the breath doesn't feel quite right, we can come back to sounds or perhaps find other sensations in our bodies that seem more appropriate. So use your own intuition, but don't try to do it perfectly. It's probably good enough, whatever is going on now. And then keeping in mind that try as we might, the attention will drift. And this isn't a mistake or a failure. It's just the normal intelligence at work. And so we do try to keep the attention stable, but we won't keep it st perfectly stable. So when we realize the attention has been drawn, it might even just be a loud sound unexpected. So we can note hearing. It's so funny, the neighbor's dog just started barking right on cue for me. So just note hearing. You don't have to make a speech like I just did. Just notice to come and bring the attention back. Just like the neighbor's dog barking, we might have thoughts that are barking at us. And yeah, we can notice that, maybe that emotion, whatever is behind it. Just okay, yeah, recognize that. So we're not trying to be some other person or even change what's happening, even when we wish it were different. And the change can happen for sure by virtue of this activity, but it's always with this sort of gentle, persistent, quiet approach, and always permissible, whatever might be entangling us, just to come back. Where's my breath? Where's the next in-breath happening? So I'll be silent for a while. We can practice together. Yeah, so thank you. It's good to practice with you this way. The basics are relatively simple, yet it's good to be reminded, and it's certainly nice to kind of gather together to meditate together. How often a week do you meditate? Question in the chat. I meditate every day. I've meditated almost every day since 1982. I've found it pretty doable for me to do it early in the day. Usually nowadays I make some coffee and sit around a little bit and then meditate. It was really important for me when I was a grad student in philosophy, and I heard about meditation. And I had a book with some guidance to not time it, and to kind of take joy in doing it for 3 minutes. Although I wasn't timing it, it wasn't more than 3 minutes. And but I got in the habit of doing it every day because it was like, wait, this could be interesting. And I didn't have people to talk with really. This is a long time ago, kids. But I somehow, for me, this is just my story. We all would have our different stories, but I'm glad to answer personal questions because it can be helpful. It was important to kind of get in the habit of doing it regularly. And even though I also wasn't trying to do it for any length of time. And so that being said, there have been times when I, realize, okay, I'm serious about this. So I've set up time standards to some extent just to kind of to go work on it. And of course, I've done many long retreats too, where I spend all day basically doing sitting and standing and walking meditation, bringing awareness into every aspect of the day, including just walking, not doing walking meditation, but just walking here and there, opening a door by pushing, closing a door by pulling, kind of bringing attention into the movement of the arms. Eating is an opportunity to practice mindfulness on retreats. And so, thanks for your question, Dad. I do meditate every day, almost every day, and I encourage people to do so. It's like a skill, like any skill. It can take practice. We will come to this with different aptitudes and different strengths. The Buddhist psychology is extremely interesting on this point, that we ha people have differing aptitudes, differing strengths, and we use the strengths that we have. And it's important for that reason not to be comparing ourselves that much to other people or even to what we think should be happening, even at the same time, kind of trusting this process that it can be something that we can develop and so forth. Lindsay, do you have your hand up? You can unmute and ask if you wish.
Yes, so I'm curious because you've practiced over the years different lengths of time with meditation and different styles, yes. But with the different lengths of time, have you noticed, whether the 3 minute meditation is especially different to the, say, 30 minute meditation? I know an all day one obviously is going to be different, but whether the 3 minutes,
Not now. For me, like what my practice is strong enough that if I sit for 3 or 5 minutes, it's comparable to if I sit for an hour in terms, even though they're definitely there's very interesting, the mind is extremely interesting, and we can cultivate a way of becoming more concentrated so that there are shifts and so forth. This is well documented in the Buddhist psychology and so forth. For me in the beginning, it was really important to somehow I had the capacity not to evaluate that much what was happening. I would just do it. It's like, okay, that kind of made sense today. And then get up and make breakfast. Yeah, this is very personal, but for in general, I would say that kind of getting a regular habit, like some of you have this Monday as a regular habit, and you manage to be here at 12:30 Pacific time. It's like use that same kind of ability to kind of bring it into your day, even when you're on your own, and perhaps use an app. Use our UCLA Mindful app. Maybe even just hear me doing it if you want, but. One virtue of hearing me do it every day would be you'll get tired of it. Even if you're not getting tired of it on a weekly basis, you would have to get tired of it on a daily basis. And it would suddenly occur to you, oh, I could do this without having someone yapping at me at all. And you definitely can, for sure. This idea of bringing it into to daily life. Eating meditation. Someone mentioned eating meditation a couple of weeks ago. I just saw it when I was closing the Zoom and meant to bring it. It's like we can bring, so having a daily practice or frequent practice is good, but we also can bring mindfulness into our daily lives and into daily activities. And a couple of points about that. One is we might have a certain activity like eating, where it's kind of like, yeah, we're curious. What would it be like to try to be more mindful? I taught quite a lot during the pandemic with Cara Lai. Some of you know her, and there was something about teaching retreats together on Zoom where we would get. She would just it would, breakfast was a perfect example of something that could be done so well on Zoom because she would give a little speech, we'd go get our breakfast and come back 8 minutes later, and then eat. She would guide you. Here, there, I just posted some. This is a video of Kara teaching eating meditation. She does it in a profound way. It's not a trivial activity for her. So we can bring mindfulness into ordinary activities like opening and closing a door and so forth. I would suggest, though, to be gentle with it, and not, definitely stay away from the idea that you should be mindful all the time, no matter what you're doing. We already have plenty to do. And I don't think it's a great idea to add be mindful all the time to our to-do list. So maybe find some activities where it's kind of fun and interesting to do it, in addition to a daily practice. How do you clear and stop thoughts and fears, even when focusing on the breath? We really don't try to stop anything in meditation. We do not have to clear our minds. I'm pretty confident about this. There may be methods that do kind of focus on that, but we notice the thoughts, we notice the fears. So we try to focus on the breath, but there will be times where our mind goes to the fears and the thoughts. We recognize these are thoughts, thinking. We recognize fear. This is fear. We try to feel our bodies in the torso. There often are sensations, visceral sensations that are a component of the fear. And then, without having cleared the mind or stopped anything, we just gently bring the attention back to the breath. And just as you can focus on this hand, even when this other hand is flitting around. That's how we do it. In the midst of the fear, we can still stay with the breath and it will get lost again and so forth. Good question, Alan. I'm coming to there. We're doing a retreat in person this Saturday. I do not know if we bring our own food. Stay tuned. Check the website. I'll make sure they clarify that there. Good questions today. Firsthand materials talking about the ancient meditation practice. I would recommend Joseph Goldstein's book called Mindfulness. There's also a German monk named Anna Laiho who has a great book on, I can't remember what it's called, but mindfulness is in the title. And this is, of course, a book I've used for undergrads since 1998. Can't see the title because I got too much page on it, Mindfulness in Plain English by Bhante Venupolo Gunaratana. It's free, freely available online. Thank you all. It's good to practice with you. Thanks for the questions and the interaction. Oh, Galaxy Note 9. Yes, you can ask a question. We seem to be taking more time.
Is the goal, let's say that you're focused on your breath or a sound, whatever it is you've chosen, is the goal, and I've wondered this for a very long time, to continue to focus on that? Or once you actually have gotten into the rhythm where you're just kind of, you've almost tuned out, are you supposed to go back and then think, oh my gosh, I just stopped paying attention? You don't have any other thoughts in your mind. You're not falling asleep. You almost have cleared your mind. Is it to get to that point, or is it to notice it and go, oh, I've stopped thinking of sounds, and go back to that?
That's a great question. Thank you. It gets into like in the big picture, why are we doing this? Right. And a couple of things. One is like taking the attention to the breath as the home base, but recognizing there can be other places to focus. The reason we do this is it works to help deepen concentration. And this is it can be made very precise, this notion of concentration. And the Buddhist psychology does make it precise. And one thing that becomes clear is as the mind becomes concentrated, things do begin to shift. And so quite naturally, the attention can be drawn, for instance, to pleasant sensations permeating the body, for example, piti and sukha, Pali words, kind of. And so it's not a failure in that moment to have been pulled away from the breath, because that quite naturally happens as we become more concentrated. And so the short answer is, even as we become more concentrated, there will be times where the attention is drawn away from the breath because of the fact that the mind is becoming more concentrated. And secondly, the breath will still be available to some extent when we need it, right? Even in those moments, especially in those moments where it's like, wait, what happened? It went wrong. Things went wrong, you know, which can be an experience that meditators have. And then, you know, there will be times where the mind is relatively clear and so forth. As you already know, even if this is your first time here, I'm not a big fan of that as a model of what we're trying to get. And it's certainly not something we have to try to get, but it can be interesting when the mind is relatively clear of thoughts. And then that is usually interrupted by the thought, I'm not thinking, right? And then it's like, oh yeah, well, I wasn't thinking. But there can be states of concentration that are relatively free of thoughts, and those are interesting and so forth. But these things can't be discussed without, thirdly, getting to the story of the Buddha, which is briefly, super briefly, you know, these forms of concentration meditation were widely available in India at the time of the Buddha. And the traditional story of the Buddha is he, you know, one thing led to another, and he had the wherewithal to go exploring and was pretty adept at learning these different forms of concentration. And so the story is that, you know, he would study with one teacher and kind of get a certain level of concentration. And the teacher would say, well, you know, that's all I got, but there's a guy down the road who can go to an even deeper state. You should go talk to him. And so the Buddha kind of exhausted all the teachers and still wasn't satisfied, even though he was very familiar with these refined, exquisite states of concentration, which are really good. And the traditional story of the Buddha is the reason he wasn't satisfied is because even in these exquisite, pleasurable states, he noticed that the suffering of clinging to the states. And it's like, damn, you know, they're not good enough. And so the traditional story of the Buddha is that he made a discovery. He went beyond merely refining these quiet states to a sort of freedom where it didn't matter what states were present. He wasn't suffering. And so this is a story of the Buddha, and the key to this sort of freedom in his teachings is crystal clear. And as far as I can see, the key is mindfulness. So we practice mindfulness in meditation. We practice deepening concentration because that helps us with the mindfulness. But when we're bringing attention to fear, right, we're actually practicing mindfulness with a difficult state. The concentration helps us stay with what it's like. And that's the path that the Buddha taught to freedom. And even with good states, right, with pleasant states, it can be very interesting to notice the kind of the clinging to those states. And if you click on Karalai's thing on eating meditation, there's no doubt she'll touch on this, right? Because even with pleasant states, we can suffer in the sense that, you know, like we're trying to make it last, even though it's something that won't last and so forth. So this is where you get into some of the more core Buddhist teachings, but they're not that complicated. And the idea that the mind can be free of suffering no matter what happens is quite an amazing idea for us as humans. And I think there are many of us still in the room here, is it there are who have enough experience to say, yeah, I have noticed that it's not all or nothing. It's not like I'm completely free, but there have been moments where, not in meditation, but just driving around or dealing with a difficult person or something, where I've noticed that I'm suffering less than I used to, right? Even in a difficult situation. And this is where these core Buddhist ideas can become quite inspiring, to see how far we can take them, right? And it's not a model. It is, and I don't know everything here, so take what I say with a grain of salt. But I say this with some confidence. It's not a model of a life free of pain, right? So there, you know, there'll be physical pain. There'll be different types of emotional pain. But the question is, can we be in those states without suffering as much or suffering at all? And the model of enlightenment in the Buddhist world, as I understand it, is, yeah, partial enlightenment is suffering less. Full enlightenment is not suffering at all, even in the midst of physical pain or emotional pain, right? The reason I say that with confidence is the point about the model isn't somehow not suffering, or, you know, having a mind that's super clear so we don't have any real experience or blah, blah, blah. It, you know, is like we're humans. We have human bodies. We're subject to pain. And also, it does not make sense to me that an enlightened person would not feel grief or anger or fear and so forth. Those are natural human emotions. It would be odd not to feel grief in certain circumstances. But the question is, can we be feeling that? Can we have that emotion and still have some degree of freedom or a lot of freedom? And so the breath can be a good anchor for us. For me, it continues to be a good anchor, right? But there are other people, this is where there are different types of people, different strengths and so forth. And so for differing strengths, differing people, there may be differing paths and so forth. And even the concept of Nibbana, it's very interesting. There are at least two major conceptual interpretations of what that concept means in Buddhism. And as someone who did not approach this sort of thing to get a theory or a religion or something, I take a great deal of delight in the fact that there are two competing, conflicting interpretations of Nibbana, right? Because that takes the pressure off. So Temple Smith, Joseph Goldstein, both talk freely about Nibbana these days. The concept of Nibbana, I've been talking around it. It's connected with this idea of freedom, so that we can know things without being entangled. So there's a Buddhist nun from Thailand whose name slips my mind. I could find it, but who talks about nibbana as unentangled knowing, unentangled knowing. And the entanglement would be with kind of the states of grasping, clinging, and so forth. So, yeah, thanks for your attention. It's good to chat too. Yeah, keep practicing.
Thanks for listening to the UCLA Mindful Monday Meditation. For more information about our classes, workshops, and retreats, please visit uclahealth.org/UCLA Mindful. Join us each week for a new session on mindfulness.